offering a loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. We welcome you, dear listeners, to this week's episode of Shravanam, Mananam, Nididhyasanam. As always, this is Prem from Team Radio Sai, and with me is Brother Hari Shankar from the Central Trust. But today we're glad to have another person joining us for this week's episode, and in a sense, I'm being outnumbered here because we have two people from the Sri Satya Sai Central Trust, and we're very, very glad to have one of our seniors, again, Swami's student who is working in the Sri Satya Sai Central Trust, Brother Pradeep. He's going to be joining us, but he's joining us with far more credentials than people like me and Sai Prakash and Hari Shankar host this program, so we're very, very happy to have him on the show. So before I ask Hari to introduce him, and before I also add a few words about him, we offer our most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet, and we begin this program. Sai Ram Hari, and Sai Ram, and welcome, sir, to the program.
Sai Ram Prev.
So we have Pradeep sir, who is first of all one of the senior most staff, who is a student of Swami, who is working in the Central Trust. Apart from that, again, he is also an engineer who graduated with his master's in business administration from Swami's University in the year 95. But more than that, what he brings to this program is a wealth of knowledge, especially in the field of Upanishads and Vedanta. So Hari, I think you should tell people how silently sir has been literally a treasure trove of wisdom relating to Vedas and Vedanta.
Yes, if somebody were to ask him about Pradeep, one of the first thing that strikes me is that from the time I know him, he's been sticking to the path of devotion, to the path of sadhana, and like very, very assiduously he practices his meditation and without fail goes for the morning Nagar Sankirtan. So he's a very recognizable face.
Right.
In the Nagar Sankirtan bhajan that is conducted in Prashanti Nilayam. And apart from that, I think the fact that he has got a very deep knowledge and that spirit of inquiry is very deep in him. And that is also reflected in the way he behaves. Like that has been always a source of inspiration to me, unflappable. No, so it's not just a theoretical knowledge of what spirituality is, but I can see it in practice. And one of the first things I recall, this was soon after I joined for my MBA, we were in Trai Brindavan. Swami had called some of the staff who were working in Prashanti Nilayam, and Swami, so Pradeep, I saw him holding up a book. And Swami looked at him, he said, he called out his name, he said, Pradeep? He said, yes, Swami. So I didn't know what was going on. I saw him offer a book to Swami. Swami opened it and wrote something in it. And it was only later that day I realized that he had actually authored a book called The Path of Knowledge. This was his first of six books that he has written, all on spiritual topics, very profound books. And he has written on eight minor Upanishads. We'll of course be finding out more about that. He has written on the Bhagavad Gita and on the Sandhyavandanam, the procedure, the significance of Sandhyavandanam, in a book called Sadachara Sandhyavandanam, and a book that he's in the process of writing and publishing is a book on the Mandukya Upanishad. So all in all, about six books that he has authored. So it is like a real privilege to have him amongst us today.
Of course, sir. So I think so. We should give you the mic and we can sit back for the rest of the program. Thank you very much for joining us, sir.
Thank you.
As we've, for listeners who have been regular to our program, they will know that this entire series, the 1991 Samoko series, is about the Upanishads. And Swami was taking Upanishads one by one. We completed the sixth discourse, which was about the Prashnopanishad, but one of the many questions that the students of Pipilada go and ask him, that was what was covered as part of the sixth discourse. The seventh one is Swami continues with the questions and the discussion which happens between them. So I think, sir, to start with, probably it would be wonderful to hear from you in what way the body of knowledge that Upanishads are, they stand out from the, because Indian culture is rich with literature and with content such as this. But even in this, the Upanishad stands out. I think internationally also, people, when they look at Indian tradition and Indian literature, they have a separate place and, you know, regard for what the Upanishads are. So what way they stand apart? I think that would be nice to start the discussion with.
Thank you, Prem, and thank you, Harishankar, for introducing me. Whatever pages you have given me, I feel is just a grace of Swami, God and Guru. So because of His grace only I could write 6 books. Now regarding your question, what is Upanishad? We all have firm faith in Vedas. Vedas means revealed knowledge. A knowledge which cannot be got, cannot be arrived through sense perception or even through mental intelligence using logic and other things. So this is revealed knowledge, different from what is perceived through sense. It is a superphysical knowledge, you can say. And we call this knowledge as intuition.
Right.
So these Vedas are given to us, to the entire mankind, since ages. These Vedas are not composed by anybody. Rather, it is revealed to the sages who meditated on the primal principle called Brahman, or you call Purusha, or you call God. So these have been revealed to the sages, and they have written whatever they perceived in their language. At that time, whatever language was prevalent, they have written in that, based on their tradition system. So you know that there are 4 Vedas: Rig Veda, Yajur Veda, Sama Veda, Atharvana Veda. And each Veda is divided into 4 parts. First one is called Sanghita. Mm-hmm. Second one is called Brahmana. Third one is called Aranyaka. And fourth one is called Upanishad. Sanghita portion contains mantras addressed to various deities: Indra, Varuna, all those things. Then Brahmana portion is application of these mantras in daily rituals of, at the time, priests or Brahmanas. Aranyaka is meant for those who have retired from the society, active involvement from society, they have gone to forest. So that's why it is called Aranyaka. They used to do penance, tapasya. So that is called Aranyaka. They stay in forest and they used to do fasting and other things, practices which is prevalent at that time. Then Upanishad means knowledge. What was the necessity of Upanishad? If Vedas, already we had Sanghita portion. Actually, if you see, Vedas are divided primarily 2 parts. First one is called Karma Kanda, which is action oriented, and another portion is called Jnana Kanda. Sages realized that it is not enough if we are involved in rituals, various practices. So they said, na anya pantha anay vidyate tamay vidvan amita ye bhavati. By knowing Him alone, we attain liberation. There is no other path. So the task of Upanishad seers was to reveal this knowledge portion, which is meant for liberation. Karma Kanda portion was meant for attainment of heaven. Heaven means after some time you feel happy after your physical death, the death of the physical body. But there is a time when those water merits you've acquired through rituals, it gets exhausted. That's why Bhagavad Gita says, Chine Punya Mittulok Vishanti. Again, we enter into the physical world from the heaven. Then there is another path which leads to which is freedom from the rebirth, which is called liberation. So this Upanishads are meant for seeking liberation, moksha. And Karmakanda portion is meant for heaven, attaining heaven. So that is the how sages have divided this entire Veda.
Right. So probably a question which comes to my mind as you were explaining is, what way, if a person looks at the Upanishads, what way is knowledge really connected to liberation? Like, I can understand Karmakanda being related to worldly living. Like, what is the best way to carry on your life if you're a priest, if you're a king? But what way is knowing or having a certain knowledge about, as we were talking in the previous discourse, Swami was talking about knowledge is not enough, awareness is important, and awareness is something like a complete knowledge. So in what way is complete knowledge related to liberation, as you were explaining?
Yes. There are two types of knowledge. One is called differentiated knowledge. Differentiated knowledge means we have got various, we see so many things in the world, even let us say science, technology, we are seeing the multiplicity. We are dividing atoms and seeing their chemical structure, defining their name, helium, hydrogen, like that. We are seeing diversity. But there is one knowledge called integrated knowledge. Means seeing everything through an integrated vision. So that is what is called conscious integrated, what Swami used to call conscious integrated awareness. That is pragya.
Right.
So when we speak of in context of Vedas, we always mean integrated knowledge, not this superficial knowledge, not bookish knowledge, not differential knowledge, but where we see whole things with an integrated vision. Entire world is seen through integrated vision. Taddishno param padgam sada pasanti surya. So that is the Veda say, the wise here see everything with an integrated vision.
Right. So I think
Pradeep sir, something that I have been interested in is, see, when we hear about the Upanishads, they speak about the Mukhya Upanishads, you got principal Upanishads, and then you have written about the minor Upanishads. So could you tell us, like, on what, like, why do we call something a principal Upanishad, why is something a minor Upanishad? Because it's definitely not size, you know.
Right.
There
yes.
are some which are very compact,
like, yes. even the Prashnopanishad is quite a concise one.
Very concise.
Right?
Yeah.
Even the earlier one, Kinopanishad, also is a very, very small Upanishad.
Each Veda has got so many branches. Rigveda has got some 21 branches. Samveda has got almost 100 branches. And Yajurveda has got maximum branches, some 700 to 800 branches. Mm-hmm. And Atharvaveda has got around 50 to 60 branches.
Hmm.
So total is around 1,000 branches, a little more than 1,000 branches.
Mm-hmm.
Each branch of Veda has got one Upanishad associated with it.
Mm-hmm.
So there should be approximately 1,000 Upanishads should be there.
Mm-hmm.
But over a period of time, most of the Upanishad got lost.
Mm-hmm.
Only 108 Upanishads are mentioned in Prashna. Muktika Upanishad.
Mm.
Of course, there are some publishers who have published around 250 numbers. That also, but mainly we talk about 108 Upanishads since it is mentioned in the Muktika Upanishad. Out of this 108 Upanishad, 10 Upanishads are called principal Upanishad. Why we and other balance are called minor Upanishad. Why do we call this as a principal Upanishad? Is because minor Upanishad, nobody has written any commentary. So everybody interprets according to one own level.
No
of
authority to commentary
yes.
on these.
Only and those Upanishad on which Bhagavad Pada Shankaracharya has written commentary, those are considered authentic one.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why they are called principal Upanishad. Others are called minor Upanishad. Minor Upanishad doesn't mean that they are insignificant. They also have got very profound philosophy. Like Muktika Upanishad itself is there, Nirvana Upanishad is there.
Mm-hmm.
So they are very profound philosophies are there. Only thing, there is no authentic commentary on those Upanishads. So mm-hmm. that's why we have to refer here and there. But For 10 Upanishads, we always know Prabhupada has written, so we can always refer that commentary.
So, remember, I think in the first time when the Samukos was held, we've been discussing Samukos discourses in this season and the previous one. The first time when Swami conducted the Samukos, Swami named it the Samukos in Indian culture and spirituality, and the elders then went and asked Swami, what sub-theme can we have? Because there should be some theme every year so that we can dilate on that and we can ask speakers to speak on that. And Swami's immediate response was, how can you speak about Indian culture and teach Indian culture without talking about Veda and Vedanta? So that's why the first Samukos itself was, the theme was Vedas and Vedanta. So that's the importance that Swami gives. And I mean, as we were going through even the last discourse, it really beats us how Swami, you know, stands there on the podium and speaks such wisdom to 17-year-olds, 18-year-olds, and I dare say uninitiated students. But I think Swami, as you were saying, that this wisdom is not in the mind or the knowledge of the mind, which is confined to age. The understanding which we have is based on how many years we have studied and how many years we have gone through these texts. But certainly Swami was addressing something which was beyond that, something which was more subtler than the superficial mind and understanding. So I think we'll continue with the discourse. This is a new discourse we're going to start today, dear listeners. The seventh discourse in the series. This again is Prashnopanishad. In the Samoshavas book, the chapter is named Prashnopanishad, Answers to the Second and Third Students. So we'll commence that. We'll play the first clip and we'll discuss about what Swami says. And of course, any other insights about Upanishads are always welcome. You can share it on the program, sir.
అత్తమందున ప్రతిబింబమంట నటుల అత్తమందున ప్రతిబింబమంట నటుల తామరాకులు నీటిచే తడుప నటుల అద్దమందున ప్రతిబింబమంటు నటుల తామరాకులు నీటిచే తడుపనటుల పాపములు పాపములు అంటవు మానవుని భక్తి వలన పాపములంటవు మానవుని భక్తి వలన పాపములు అంటము మానవుని భక్తి వలన అంటము మానవుని భక్తి వలన
జస్ట్ as man's reflection does not get stuck to the mirror, just as water does not get attached to the lotus leaves. Lotus leaves are not wet by the water. So also, an account of devotion, sins will never touch the man. If only man has devotion, he will not be touched by sins.
Janana maranalu rendunu jantanundu. జనన మరణాలు రెండును జంట నుండు రెండు చక్రాల బండి ఎందుండినటుల జనన మరణాలు రెండును జంట నుండు రెండు చక్రాలు బండిని నుండునటుల ఒకటి పోయిన సృష్టియే ఓడిపోవు ఇదియే సృష్టి రహస్యందు ఈ ధరణి మీద ఇదియే సృష్టి రహస్యమీ ధరణి మీద
బర్త్ అండ్ డెత్ are inseparable, they go together. Two wheels are essential for any chariot to move. If one goes between birth and death, if one goes, creation itself will come to a standstill. This is the secret of creation which you may understand.
ప్రేమస్వరూపులైన విద్యార్థులారా,
స్టూడెంట్స్ ఎంబాడిమెంట్స్ ఆఫ్ డివైన్ లవ్,
ఏకోహం బహుశ్యా, ప్రజాపతి యొక్క సత్సంకల్పము చేత మూలము స్థూలము, జడము చైతన్యము, ప్రాణము ప్రాణి అనే జంటలను సృష్టించి వాటి యొక్క సంయోగము చేతనే జగత్తు చరాచర ప్రపంచమంతయుడును సృష్టింపబడుతూ వచ్చింది.
ఆన్ అకౌంట్ ఆఫ్ ది సేక్రెడ్ విల్ ఆఫ్ ప్రజాపతి, ద డ్యూయాలిటీ, ద రూట్ అండ్ ద గ్రాస్ అండ్ ద కాన్షియస్నెస్, మ్యాటర్ అండ్ ఎనర్జీ, ద లైఫ్ అండ్ ద లివింగ్ బీయింగ్స్, దే వర్ ఆల్ క్రియేటెడ్. And thus the process of life is carried on.
Kanuka charachara prapanchamunakantai kudanu prani aina suryudu, pranamaina suryudu, prani aina chandrudu, ee rendinti yokka samyogame moola karanamani ninnati dinamu katya maharshi yokka manumudainatundi yokka కదంబికి బోధించాడు.
ది మూవింగ్ అండ్ ది అన్మూవింగ్, ఆల్ ద లివింగ్ బీయింగ్స్ ఆర్ బేస్డ్ అపాన్ ద సన్ హూ ఈజ్ లైఫ్, ద మూన్ హూ ఈజ్ ద లివింగ్ బీయింగ్, అండ్ దస్ ద సీక్రెట్ ఆఫ్ లైఫ్ అండ్ హౌ ఇట్ ఈస్ బీయింగ్ క్యారీడ్ ఆన్ వాజ్ టాట్ టు ద గ్రాండ్ సన్ ఆఫ్ కచ్చ మహర్షి. ది నేమ్ ఆఫ్ దట్ మహర్షి ఈజ్ కదంబి.
కదంబి ఋషివాక్యములను చక్కగా శ్రవణము చేసి సృష్టి రహస్యాన్ని గుర్తించి ఆనందముతో తాను తన హృదయమును నింపుకుని ఉండగా విదర్భ దేశీయుడైనటువంటి యొక్క మరొక శిష్యుడు భార్గవుడు ప్రవేశించి,
వెన్ కదంబి హర్డ్ ది teachings of the great sage, filled his heart with all the secrets of creation, at that time another disciple from Vidarbha by name Bhargava came there.
Pippilada Maharshiki namaskarinchi, Swami janana maranamulu teerani badhalaga untunnavi.
If folded his hands, offered salutations to the sage Pippilada and said that birth and death are rather difficult.
Puttina vaadu gittaka, gittina vaadu puttaka tappadani samasta shastramulu kudanu prabodhistu unnavi.
All these scriptures teach that any person who is born has to die, and any person who dies has to take again
birth. Janana maranamulo chetane ee jeevitamu ఈ విధంగా గడిచిపోయినా దీనికి అంత్యం ఎప్పుడు, దీనికి ఆధారం ఏమిటి అనేటువంటి యొక్క ప్రశ్నను ప్రశ్నించాడు పిప్పిలాద మహర్షి.
ది క్వశ్చన్ వాజ్ పుట్ టు పిప్పిలాద మహర్షి దట్ ఇఫ్ లైఫ్ గోస్ ఆన్ లైక్ దిస్ విత్ బర్త్స్ అండ్ డెత్స్, వాట్ ఈస్ ది ఎండ్ ఫర్ దిస్, వాట్ ఈస్ ది బేసిస్ ఫర్ దిస్.
నాయన, ఆద్యాంతరహితుడు భగవంతుడు.
చైల్డ్, గాడ్ ఈజ్ బిగినింగ్ లెస్ అండ్ ఎండ్ లెస్.
కేవలము చరాచర ప్రపంచమంతయి కూడాను మిథ్యమైనటువంటిది.
ద మూవింగ్ అండ్ అన్మూవింగ్ వరల్డ్ ఈజ్ ఓన్లీ ట్రాన్సిటరీ.
మిథ్యమునందు సత్యం ఉండినప్పటికీ స్వరూపము నిరూపమయ్యేటువంటిది.
దేర్ ఈస్ ట్రూత్ ఇన్ దిస్ ట్రాన్సియంట్ వరల్డ్ బట్ that has to be established on the basis of
ivanni kudanu anchamuto koodinatvantivi.
Everything comes to an end.
Suryuni valana samvatsaramulu
So that was the first clip in that discourse. Pretty much an introductory part where Swami is not going into the answer as such, because he's asked a very profound question. In fact, that's exactly what we were talking when we were talking about Upanishad. Sir, we were saying that one can reach a state of happiness in life or even after life, but the question is how to go beyond that cycle of life and death. And that's precisely what the question Sage Bhargava is asking here, right?
Yes, actually the first part of the Prashnopanishad, the discourse which we were discussing in the last few weeks, so there we actually dealt with the question, like a preliminary question, which is like, how did this entire creation come into being? And so Swami is actually recapitulating that.
Right.
You know, he's saying that it was the Prajapati with the power of the, with the will of God, right? And he creates this. So what we last time we saw, no, Swami spoke about the prana and rai, so the combination of energy and matter,
inert matter,
right? And so the interplay between them is what has created this entire world. So that was an answer to the first question which he posed, right? Which,
right.
So that is what Swami is bringing up again, right? And so the next question which arises is like, again, a fundamental question, like, so this life has arisen, and is there a way out of it? So as we can see, there are cycles that, so you born, you die, you born again, you die. Is there a way out?
Right.
So that is what the, so if you see, the that was actually the original intent of the disciples who came to Sage Pipalaya. They want to realize Brahman. They want to get at that secret which will take them out of this loop.
Right.
So that is, I think that is what the discourse will be addressing for all of
and,
us.
And because one thing which strikes me is, like the previous discourse we started, Swami started with a padyam which spoke about seva.
Mm.
It started by saying that paropakarartham idam shariyam, that's the purpose of life.
Yeah.
And again, here is a discourse on an Upanishad, which starting with devotion, actually.
Mm.
Swami says, like, image does not stick to a mirror, like water does not stick to the leaf of a lotus. Sin does not stick to a devotee. So it would be interesting to see how Swami develops the theme to, you know, come to that point where Swami speaks about devotion. But before that, I mean, this is again a question which often comes to mind when you're talking about Vedanta. Always the words Dvaita and Advaita is used. But when we look around, there is multiplicity. It's not just two. It's not just oneness and duality. So here Swami clearly says that how the creation comes about with creation of duality. The base and the based.
Mm.
The inert and the conscious. And I think, sir, I think we should ask you, because many of the Upanishads differ in their philosophy based on the way they treat the relationship between these two, the inert and the conscious, or the based and the basis, isn't it, sir?
If you see, the highest philosophy is that everything is one. Sarvam Kaloidam Brahma. If you see how the creation started, we go to Nasatiya Suktam, it says it started with the absolute. There is nothing, neither existence nor non-existence. So it was absolute. We call that absolute entity as a Brahman. So whole thing was, entire thing was Brahman only. But how this Brahman becomes Ishvara, we call, having all creative powers, it is through tapas. That's what Nasadiya Suktam says. Through tapas, absolute Brahman becomes Ishvara, the Lord of creation. After that only, there comes differentiation of energy and matter, not before that.
Right.
So, through will of Ishvara only, that we call it a consciousness, that consciousness creates various grades of existence, various planes, starting from highest plane. We refer to seven Vyaharti in the Vedas. Bhu, Bhuvah, Swaha, Maha, Janaha, Tapaha, Satyam. So Bhu is a material plane. Bhuvai is a vital plane full of life force. Suha is mental plane. Jana Maha is a plane of Vijnana. Jana, Tapaha, Satyam, these are called three spiritual planes.
Mm-hmm.
Which is called Satchit Ananda in the Upanishad. So Isvara will create this descending orders of existence. It finally materializes as a Bhu. So what Swami used to say, first is radiation, then vibration, then materialization.
Right.
So that is how creation comes into existence.
Right.
Through will of Isvara.
Actually, you were just mentioning through tapas. So, in fact, we read that, you know, the Prajapati through tapas he creates. That is what is spoken about in the first answer. This word tapas has actually two meanings. So, what we commonly understand is like penance.
Right.
Or contemplation.
Austerity.
Austerity, etc. But the actual basis of the word tapas is heat. Right. So, like, how do you interpret when you say that Prajapati out of his tapas created these two forces? Like, how do you understand what it is?
I always refer to Upanishads, Shrutis, to find out what is the actual meaning. Munduka Upanishad says, tapas means a reflection of what is already there. Isvara, through his own inherent meditation, or you say, brings out whatever was there in previous creation. So it is a bringing out whatever was inherent in the knowledge was inherent in the Isvaras.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So that is called tapas. It is basically, it is a intense contemplation on the whatever you want to create. So this is called tapas, bringing out from your within.
Right.
So
I think that's where probably the idea of tapas itself comes, even in human beings, where Swami says that, you know, all of spirituality is bringing out from within. You don't really acquire or gather from outside. In fact, that is what differentiates regular knowledge from the higher wisdom. The whole idea is to bring out from within. Actually, just yesterday, one of the boys in the radio show was asking, you know, we keep hearing this many, many times, that you have to go within, you have to turn your vision inward. So you're saying, what does it actually mean? Like, what would you say for that? So what does it actually mean to when you say you turn within, everything that has to be attained is inside you?
In the Kita Yuga, tapas was the most fundamental practice. Later on, it became Dwapara. As we came to Kali Yuga, we have devotion, various rituals. But in the Kita Yuga, people used to meditate and intensely get the intuitive knowledge of whatever existed previously. Past, present, future. So, we have heard Swami saying that Sage Vishwamitra, through his tapas, could create another universe. Means you see. So, of course, this was against the will of God, so he has to withdraw that. But see, this is the bringing out all gods from within through tapas. He could create all gods through his will power.
I think that's the story of Trishanku, right? That's
Trishanki, of course, different case. There was a different spiritual concept was involved. Trishanku wanted to see heaven with the physical body.
Right.
Which nobody can accomplish. This is a bhuloka, that is mrityuloka, full of physical matter. That is beyond matter, mental plane. But Trishanku has a very unique desire. I want to see the heaven with this physical body. So how to accomplish? He went and prayed to Vishwamitra. Sir, I want to see this, what is heaven? So it was, he prayed to Vishwamitra. Okay, he accepted his request and he started transforming his physical constituent of the body with tapas.
Okay.
He could change this physical constituent of the body, make it astral and more subtle. And he was sending him to heaven, but it was against the will of Indra. So he was thrown from there, from heaven. And here is a force applied by tapas of Vishwamitra, and there Indra is obstructing. So finally he was nowhere. He was neither in this heaven nor in earth. He was hanging in the middle of Antariksha. So it is a really nobody can adventure to do that, but Vishwamitra did. He did try. So it is a really a very profound mystery how Vishwamitra could attain such power. To even met, change the constitute of the body and transport him to a different plane.
Mm-hmm. Actually, even as sir was speaking, see, like I think earlier also when we were referring to the Upanishads, one of the things we try and compare is to like the theories of creation which arise from science.
Right.
So, like when sir mentioned that tapas, this is the first time I'm actually hearing this interpretation, but tapas is bringing out those aspects which were already there, like pre-existing in a previous version.
Right.
And then you are bringing it out. You know, like how we speak about, I think maybe the Indian spiritual tradition is perhaps the only spiritual tradition in the world, or the only religious tradition in the world which admits of worlds that get created, destroyed, again recreated and destroyed in cycles.
Cycles, right.
Right. This is the only this thing where it is posited. And like when he was speaking about that, I realized that how close it is, you know, to our present, or rather, how the present understanding of physics, as like I think as sir also mentioned, it was intuition. Like what we now are arriving at when we write these scientific theories, they come from a lot of contemplation on the what is evidenced by the senses and the mathematical underpinnings. But as he said, like when you have that intuition which is granted to you by the grace of God, that's when you can see all this with so much clarity.
Right. Yeah. I think even in science, if you were to really look at it, of course, you can't say it with authority, but much of the understanding may be led by intuition. Like,
perhaps,
you know,
yes.
We do say, definitely it does go without saying that empirical evidence is something which is very important.
Mm.
But many times the direction of the research itself might be intuitive.
Precisely.
And the scientist might be looking for empirical evidences to support an intuitive idea that has you know come about. So much comes from contemplation that way.
Yes. Basically, Veda says microcosm, macrocosm is same in the structure. Whatever is there in the universe, same thing is in the human being also. So you can drive all knowledge. It is inherent in the nature of every individual. But we are not able to do that because of our extrovert nature. When we become introvert, we are able to drive that knowledge of how the structure of cosmos. If you refer Bhutipada of Rajoga, there he mentioned, Sage Patanjali mentioned, so many powers you can drive just by contemplation, Samyam you can do, and you can get the knowledge of sun, you can get the knowledge of formation of stars, you can know the how formation of earth. All powers can be derived through that Samyam, which he calls Samyam.
Right. In fact, the analogy which I always find very striking between science and especially the Vedas, you know, when they were trying to look at space, you know, there's this correlation between the distance from where the light is coming and the number of years before that light is coming from, because of the number of light years it is away from. So now they have these very, very advanced telescopes which look as far as billions of light years away, which means you're looking at space a billion years ago, because the light has been traveling for so many billions of years. So just reading through that, when they set up this Hubble Space Telescope, they found that after a certain point, you know, however powerful your equipment is, the atmosphere tends to bend light and distorts the light which comes from outer space. So they found the only way is if you can put your telescope outside, you know, the ambit of the atmosphere. So very similarly, if you look at our rishis, as sir was saying, that just by contemplation you can actually know how stars are formed and how the constellations are placed. I think one of the first things they came upon, and like a gold mine they hit upon, is if you can put your contemplation beyond this mind, if you can remove the mind from the equation, then you almost, the possibilities are endless. You know, just like how the Hubble Space Telescope, they say it's almost got there at 13.7 billion light years. It's like the threshold of the Big Bang, right? So it's almost like that, because there's that concept of Amanaska, which they speak about in Vedas and Upanishads, where you think without the mind. I don't know if that makes sense.
I'll just add here one point. As far as this Big Bang theory is concerned, it speaks about manifested world. where lights has emerged and it is traveling. But what about possibility where light has not emerged only? It is unmanifested. What we call as causal world.
Right.
Mm. And there we say mysterious world. This is a spiritual world. Subtle world and physical world, of course, they are there. But when we refer to spiritual, this we refer to causal world only.
Right.
And where this unmanifested. So that is, you cannot even see the thing with telescope.
Mm-hmm.
There you have no other means to, there no experiment can be done.
Right.
So that is mystery which is revealed by only through Vedas.
Right.
So we need to depend on Vedas, and surprisingly many scientists are turning to Vedas now. They are finding clues from there and discovering so many hidden insights, forces, right, and other things. So now Vedas are becoming a very important sort of a
resources
for knowledge in the West.
Right. Then the other concept which Swami goes on to speak in this particular discourse, you know, where he introduces his words, I think he comes back to this again and again later, about Satya and Mithya. That is, again, I find a very interesting concept in Vedanta as such. Because if you're talking about opposites, it should be Satya and Asatya. But always you have this reference to Satya and Mithya, saying that, you know, something is truth which is eternal, and something which is momentarily true. It's not completely false. You know, you see it in front of you. You see it as existent. So you can't say it is not. But they give this is a very beautiful word they use. They say mithya. It's saying that it is not untrue in that sense, but its truth is limited. You know, it is only for a period of time.
Yes, we in Vedanta say Brahma Satya Jagat Mithya.
Right.
What we mean is, Satya means eternal. Swami always Satya means three times, all past, present, future, it is always eternal. It doesn't change. Mithya means it is neither real nor unreal. It is there for some time, it is not there for another time. For example, you take waking state is there, but it is not there in the dreaming state. Similarly, dreaming state is not there in a, what you call, susuptavastha.
Deep sleep.
So, they are there sometime when you are in that state of awareness, but they are not there when you are in a different state of awareness. So, what is not eternal, we call it is a neither real nor unreal. We say it is indefinable, anirvachaniya. So, that is what Vedanta calls this term as mithya, as anirvachaniya, indescribable.
Right.
We cannot say it is not there because it is seen.
It is seen, right.
And it is not there when, after some time. So, we don't say it is indefinable.
But interestingly enough, like if you look at the Vedas, like we were saying, that how the division is, there is the Karma Kanda and there is the Jnana Kanda.
Mm.
It's like giving as much cognizance to the Mithya as to the Satya. So you see how in the Vedas we give equal importance to the karmas, the rituals, the duties, responsibilities that you as a human being, or as a being that exists in this world, the things that you have to discharge, right? So, and the rituals, the devotional aspects, all those are emphasized as much as the truth that this is an illusion, and behind that there is a far deeper truth as the intransient truth which we call Satya. And if you look at the Ishavasya Upanishad, that you know, walks along that razor thin edge. You know, it says that there has to be a harmony between these two. I really find that very interesting. Perhaps again, if I look at the spiritual traditions of the world, there are traditions which emphasize a lot on the ritualistic aspects, and which are totally divorced from any of, you know, the knowledge or wisdom aspects. And then there are religious traditions or spiritual traditions which are so focused on the knowledge, on wisdom, right, on inquiry, that they completely miss out on the devotional aspect. But again, if you look at the several masters, the divine masters, Ramana Maharishi comes to mind, even Nisargadatta Maharaj comes to mind. If you look at all their lives, so how much they spoke about Jnana, Advaita, there were also significant aspects of devotion, Karmakanda, even in their lives. So I really found it very interesting to get this parallel.
When you were reading out the number of books sir has written, I was itching to ask that question. So you've written about Upanishads, you've also written about Bhagavad Gita. So in what way are they different? Because I've heard Swami saying in discourses that the Bhagavad Gita is in essence the essential knowledge of all the Upanishads and Vedas. But still there is a lot of difference. If you read it as a text, there seems to be so much difference in the content of what the Gita conveys and what the Upanishads convey.
Yes, Bhagavad Gita is a summary of all Upanishads. Bhagavad Gita basically tries to evolve a person from considering it as a normal human being to the highest plane, using karma marga, then gradually karma sannyasa, then dhyana yoga, then sannyasa, full sannyasa, then dhyana yoga, ultimately leading to supreme enlightenment, which is called actionlessness. We are totally absorbed, monasticism, that is called. Highest state is monasticism, where you are absorbed in Brahman. You have no karma, you have no duty, you are free from everything, you have no word, so it is totally gone. So that is the highest state. So, but to achieve that state, we cannot immediately say, no, everything is Brahman, where is the duty for me? It is not like that. As long as we have body consciousness, we need to do some duties, either duties to God or duties to Guru, or if you are a family person, you have to discharge your social responsibility. Like this, everybody has duty. So we need to perform as long as we have body consciousness. Once body consciousness is gone, there is nothing like duty, there is nothing like responsibility, you are free from all bondage. You have. So there is the, what is called, Gita finally ends in that only.
Right.
Sarvadham Patajya Mamek Saranamura. Meaning you take refuge in the self alone, the supreme self, give up all duties. So that is how slowly, slowly Gitacharya builds up that topic through karma yogas, changing the perception and all, controlling senses. Then it goes to slowly, slowly withdrawing from the worldly activity, comes sannyasa, partial renunciation of those worldly activities, then turning to dhyana yoga, meditating, contemplating the unity of the God and universe. So that's how the topics build up and finally it ends into monasticism.
Right. It reminds me of a joke which I came across some time back. You know, you have these TV shows where they ask you questions and for each question you get more money. Right? So at the end of 15 questions, you become a millionaire. You get the $1 million. So apparently one guy goes to the show and the host is explaining the sequence of the program. And he says, sir, if I answer the 15th question, I get 1 crore. He said, yes. So why don't you ask the 15th question first? Right? So because if you look at the Gita, where what Krishna says is, you know, he gives the entire journey, how you go from karma to karma, sannyasa to complete sannyasa, and as you were showing the sequence.
And Swami has told one more example he has given. Like karma yoga is like if you are going from one place to another place, you are taking a train, getting on some intermediate station, and again you take another train, finally reach your destination. That's called karma marga.
Right.
Then you have bhakti marga. Bhakti marga means what? You take train, you sit in a bogey, that bogey stops at some station, it is connected with another train, it takes you to destination. Then, but gyan marga is directly, direct train is there.
Through train.
Through train. Through train.
So it is time, matter of time. And we always see, we don't find a conflict between karma and jnana. Swami used to say, chitta suddhe karma.
Right.
Karma is meant for purity of chitta, purity of mind. And once purity attained, then chitta suddhi jnana siddhi. You get knowledge through. And once knowledge attained, jnana yuddhi kaivalyam. So you attain liberation through that knowledge. That's how steps are made.
Right.
So there is no conflict actually. All are.
Right. Of course, the beauty of the Gita is, you know, when you are looking at sages who are giving you the message, you are talking about men who are ascending to the level of the Supreme. But the beauty of Gita is where Krishna says that, look, I am coming from the beyond. And I come and do duty. I have nothing binds me to do action, but I come and do. So that should show you how much important action is and the right way of doing action. Right. So I think we'll conclude the program here because next clip is a little long. It's about 10 minutes. That's why I resisted playing that after some time. So we'll go to that clip next week Because I think the first few minutes of that discourse are quite heavy in a sense, because Swami is talking about some of these concepts which form the body of this Prashnopanishad. So we'll take it up next week. So sir, we would really be happy if you can join us again next week for this discourse. So on behalf of all of you dear listeners, I thank Brother Pradeep for joining us, and we most humbly offer this effort at Swami's lotus feet. Do join us again next week at 7:30 for the next episode of Shravanam Mananam Nididhyasanam. If you're wondering which discourse this is the 7th discourse in the Summer Showers in Vrindavan 1991. In a short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu for the last segment of today, Outside, Inside, Deep Inside. Stay tuned. Happy listening.